Welcome to School for Startups Radio. We don't have time today for our normal introduction, so we're jumping right in. We've got a cram-packed show. Chris Greco is with us to get an update. I love it when we have guests back after several years to find out how things are going, to get the changes, get the updates. He is going to talk about the adversity advantage, and I'm excited to welcome him back in just a second. After that, we have our normal Thursday Wayne Elliott update. This segment is all about the IRS and how to deal with them. If you have an attorney or a policeman or an IRS rep show up and say you owe a bunch of money, Wayne has some amazing advice on how to solve that problem. And we tell some great stories in the bottom half of the show. But let's get started with Chris Greco. Chris was with us, as I said, a couple of years ago, talking about a company that he was in the middle of turning around. It has since had a successful exit. During all of that process, he wrote a very well-received book about it called The Adversity Advantage. And we're going to sort of get an update. Chris, happy exit and welcome back.
Yeah, great to be here. The Adversity Advantage is now my keynote talk, but it's underscored by the book, 8 Steps to Overcoming Adversity. And I know sometimes that could be confusing, but yeah, I've taken that book, applied it, the lessons to, you know, scaling a company, which is really all about culture. It took 4 years, but turned it around, made customers happy, investors happy, delivered a great, and continue to deliver a great product for arguably one of the most important industries in America, which is your neighborhood grocer, important software for them. And we exited in July of this year and doing a lot of speaking and starting a newsletter on top.
So I do remember when we talked before, you pointed out that not everything needed to be shopped online and that a lot of what we were doing was just entertainment. And yep. I have to say, I have some retail shopping addictions myself.
So we all do.
Talk to us about that, shopping as entertainment.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you think about the pandemic, one of the only places that were open for that period of time, and depending on where you lived, was your neighborhood grocer. And that shopping there became theater. You got to interact with people. You walked into a grocery store, beautiful, see the beautiful colors of produce. And a lot of people became accustomed to shopping often at their store. And I think that, you know, maybe slowed the launch of online, you know, grocery shopping, but now it's increasing. But yeah, the interaction that people had during the pandemic, the grocery store became arguably, if people could not go to work, then it replaced work as their second place. So the home being the first, the grocery store, being the second. So they played an important role in the recovery. But they are here to stay in my.
We use it all the time. And
yeah,
we use several hybrids. We have some where we go to the store and it's already bagged for us. And then we have some that we have delivery. And I don't know. I think that a hybrid is where most people are going to end up.
Maybe. I mean, look, it's interesting, with the change now, we have a new administration coming in there with RFK Jr., really leaning in on this health epidemic that we have here in the U.S. I mean, I don't know if your listeners know, but there are certain foods that we consume as American consumer that are absolutely banned in Europe. And, my brother, who served, 10 years in the army, he was, did 3 tours in Afghanistan. He was stationed in Vicenza, Italy. He now lives in the States. He tells me all the time, the way Europeans shop, consume their food is vastly different, you know, from the U.S. They have a big focus on freshness and in quantity, ingredients that we just don't have here. We are an overly processed society. The CPGs, the consumer product groups, I think they need to take a hard look at what they're delivering to us. And I will welcome any changes in policy that makes our food, our consumption of food, healthier.
Yes. Even if the government mandates it?
No, I'm not in it. We got to be free market. I think there's opportunities to deliver. I think there's opportunity for the CEOs of those companies. And this would be a great segment if you put me on with, a CEO of one of the consumer product groups. I think they want to do the right thing. I'm not saying they're bad people. I mean, look, people, we have choices. We either choose to go to the gym or go to McDonald's. You can't regulate that. My point is that I think that when you go down a grocery store shelf, the center of store, there's just so much processed, there's obviously a lot of processed food, and we just do less shopping on the perimeter, which is your produce, your poultry, your fish. And we do more of our shopping in the center store. And we'd like to see that, that change. But again, it is up to the American consumer to go ahead and do that. I don't believe in that should be regulated, but I do think there should be some changes made in the way we're educated about our food choices.
Chris, just like George Costanza, I am a wannabe architect. I actually got kicked out of architecture school there at the end of my academic career. And I know enough about architecture to know one or two things. One of my favorite stories is a building spot or a site in Washington, D.C. It had a horrible angle, 19-degree angle in it, and so no one really wanted to build anything there. And I.M. Pei looked at it and said, I can put a building there, and it became the National Gallery, and it's one of the most award-winning buildings of all time. And he used that 19-degree angle as the design feature of the entire building. The entire building was the premise for it. The why of the building became that 19-degree angle. He took the hardest part of it and made it the biggest part of it, the biggest, most central feature of the entire museum. You can see it all over the museum. Okay. It seems to me that that's a really interesting example from an architectural standpoint of what you're talking about now, what your speaking career is based on. How can adversity be good for me?
Simple. The simple answer is that you can't grow without pain. Look, comfort and greatness cannot coexist. Comfort and greatness cannot coexist. So but yet as humans, we love the comfortability, right? It's natural for us to be comfortable. It's unnatural for us to, inflict suffering or pain, whether in the sense of like, if you want to prepare for an athletic event, like I've done several triathlons and one half Ironman. I mean, training 6 hours a day over the weekends, preparing is painful, right? But that's the only way that you're going to grow. So you cannot expect to really advance yourself unless you're willing to take on some level of adversity. And adversity finds us all. I mean, I always say in my speeches that there's two types of people in this world when it comes to adversity: those that have experienced it and those that will. It's a guarantee. So I think that when we, when we have hardship, when we have setbacks, pain, suffering, adversity, and that's part of the human experience. And I'm not saying it needs to be our initial reaction when it happens. Great. Let me embrace this because it's tough. I mean, I know that I will sometimes say, wow, I mean, I have to go through this, or I have to go this, and how am I going to overcome this? But if we can develop a growth mindset that this suffering or this time, which will pass, that we're going through, is meant to build us and help us grow, I think that it just sets us up for greater success in life.
What is the initial response? So when something bad happens, we're not going to make payroll, someone dies, someone's kid gets sick with a terminal diagnosis. What is the initial response? Or what should it be?
I don't think that's really that's personal, right? So if you're really to go, there's three types of adversity in my book. There's the everyday adversity that it's a long commute. You maybe had an argument with your spouse. Your child just didn't get the grade they wanted in school. The kind of think about. You have the temporary setback. For me as a CEO, believe it or not, running low on cash, the threat of missing payroll, that is a temporary setback. We never got to that point, but there's one time early on where we came close. And then there's a permanent life-changing event where a terminal illness, which I experienced with the death of my father when I was 15. All three of those will generate a different response, but it's very personal. And I can tell you, the way I looked at the latter, the permanent life-changing event, I played the role of victim. And I pointed to all of the different external circumstances. And that's a natural response. I go back again. We don't want to get out of our comfort zone. And so the question you ask is, what should our be response? I don't know if that's necessarily the right one. You know, I would say that it's personal and we all respond differently, but the goal that we want to get to, the outcome is like, okay, this happened to me. It's happened to billions of other people. Everyone has their different types of adversity. The way I choose to respond to this is up to me. It's up to me. That my circumstance is not necessarily unique. And so it takes time, but eventually with the right mindset, people will see their setbacks or their life-changing events or their everyday adversity is something that everyone experiences at some point in their life.
You mentioned the victim and affirming that you are not a victim. You mentioned that
that's step one
to everybody. Talk more about that. I love it when a woman gets pregnant and she starts acting like she's the first person to ever be pregnant. I think that's just funny to see. And you're right. Everyone is going to eventually lose their parents. But still, we do feel like the victim. Isn't that natural to feel like the victim?
Of course. Right? It's the way. So think about the step one in my book is affirm I'm not a victim. So I've studied this, and there's an opportunity for us to act to overcome it. And what I mean by that is I've had people say aloud, I'm not a victim. I'm not a victim. And you hear yourself saying that. I've had one of my colleagues who wrote the words, I'm not a victim, and actually burned it. And it's just this symbolism of getting past victimhood is I find to be profound. And I know that in talking with, psychologists and psychiatrists, that doing some sort of action like that helps people move past things. There's another story of a chief product officer. He built a product that absolutely failed, but he had another one coming behind it. But the company was so stuck on that failure. So what he did, I'm going dating myself back in the, early 2000s, but he actually took a piece of the product and walked everybody outside and physically buried the prop and put up a makeshift tombstone. And that, and he said that, Chris, it actually works. It's like no more talking about it. It's done. It failed. Where it's behind us. It's time to move on. And I think that it's not just a matter of, you know, thinking or reading about not becoming a victim. I think the act of saying it aloud, writing it down, bearing it, that's an early step in moving on to better things.
You also talk in the book about the routine and how it's important to, I guess, get into a routine. For me, you know, I've had some serious adversity in the last 4 or 5 years. And during that time, when things get really bad, I go outside and build something. I've got a lot of stuff built in my yard now, including Chris, a 30-foot swinging bridge.
Wow.
Built out of
30 foot high.
I think the highest point is 17 feet in the air, and it's 30 feet long.
Sweet Moses. Wow. That's an incredible project.
It was. And it was, actually one of those things that I thought about longer than it took to do. And once I figured out how to do it, it fell into place very, very, very quickly. In one afternoon, I went from ski toe ropes over my gorge. We have a creek in the backyard, and we had one side was like a big drop off where our pool had been built up, like, you know, reinforced land to make new area for the flat area for the pool. And then it dropped down to the creek, and on the other side we had a treehouse, and I had a ski rope where I thought the bridge would go. And in one afternoon, I went from there, took the first cable, bolted it on one side, walked it over to the other side, put it through the hole in the treehouse, got it in place, bolted it in, did that for all three cables, then laid my first slat in place. And when I had my first slat in place, I realized, you know, it kind of rolled downhill at that point. If I put my butt there and then put the netting that was going to be the side, you know, the side netting, used it to like stop me from sliding down, I could put each slat down. I'd put the slat down, bolt it in place, slide another 6 inches, do it again. I had that entire process was like 4 hours. And four hours later, people were like, what the hell? You know?
Wow.
But I thought about that, Chris, for 6 months.
Yeah. It's amazing there's a saying that goes, you can ponder about the thing, think about the thing, write about the thing, design the thing, plan the thing. There's nothing better than doing the thing. And I thought about my book started out as a letter to my son shortly after he was born. It's on, you know, page 103 to 106 of my book. Are about 50 life lessons I wanted him to know in case, you know, something happened. And I parked it probably for a couple years, and my, you know, my best friend and future business partner died, gave his eulogy, walked back from the podium, the eulogy. I told my wife, I'm like, hey, I gotta finish it. I gotta write this book that I've been talking. And then another 2 years transpired, and then it was published. But it's amazing the things that we're willing to think, but it's so hard for us to start, and then it's even harder for us to finish. And I think that the underlying cause of that is setbacks, adversity, and hardship. That you get past one, get past two, but the third or fourth or maybe fifth just stops us. And if you have the mindset that, hey, it's not going to be the fourth or fifth, there's going to be 10 more hardships or stuff I got to deal with whatever that I'm planning to do here, it sets you up for success, because then you expect it. And, you know, you don't necessarily have to embrace it, but you're able to deal with it better.
When you talk about the routine, is the routine, is it beneficial because you know what to do next or because you're simply moving? Why? What makes the routine beneficial, Chris?
It helps you progress. In my book, I speak to the routine. I focused in on the morning routine, which I still do today. A certain amount of reflection early in the morning. No one's bothering you. You're there by yourself. You're able to reflect, pray, read, exercise. When I'm able to go ahead and do that, and there's some mornings where I'm not able to do that. Thanksgiving is a good example. When I have a bunch of people in the house and my quiet place is now occupied by, my sister or brother or uncle. When I'm able to go ahead and do that, I notice that there's a greater kick in my day. Because there's that activity. And activity is good. Activity is good. And I think that when you're able to go ahead and establish a routine, especially post the adverse event, it helps you get past it quicker because you're seeing yourself. You can point to certain times when you're able to move past it. So the routine is actually step four in my book. I get to that pretty quickly because I know how much it has helped me, and I still carry it to this day, 25 years later.
Chris, let's take this to a more macro level. How do you lead a company through adversity? How do you say a financial situation? I grew a business to several hundred employees, and we grew too fast and had to pull back and had to deal with that and tell the company what was going to be happening and who was going to be laid off, or better word, fired and stuff. How do you lead a company through that and have people still like you and find light at the end of the tunnel?
Yeah. So, and you'll appreciate this, and I don't want to sound cliche, but culture is strategy for breakfast. And if you've established the right culture, you can get through almost anything, but it doesn't mean you still won't have setbacks. So in the case of building the early stage company, you as the, as the CEO needs to really set what good looks like, what will things be like when we get past this, because this will pass, right? I remember we had a bad sales quarter, like unexpected. I said, guys, one quarter does not define our company. One quarter. And then the next quarter was okay, and the quarter after that, we just crushed it. But events don't define us. How we respond to events define us. That's what's critical. Events don't define how we respond to it. So when I speak to events here, I mean adversity and setbacks that we all experience. But to answer your questions, that the leader needs to really paint that picture. Like, hey, here's what it looks like when you get past it. In my earlier life, I was a boat captain, and one of the first things they teach you when you're going through that process of getting licensed is navigation. And you quickly learn the difference between magnetic north and true north. And I was living in Miami at the time with my wife, and magnetic, we would go to the Bahamas not a couple times a year. And you can point your compass magnetic north at 270 degrees and get right across, but magnetic north doesn't account for wind, current, rain, swells, waves, other boats, on and on. So as you are calculating true north, which accounts for all of those, of course, adverse effects on your boat. And when I talk to my company, let's understand that it's not going to be easy sailing, that there will be times that we'll miss a quarter, we'll miss a week, we'll have a surprise resignation, we'll have a customer that leaves us. But we have the foundation to, you know, to get past this, and we will get past this. And I think that that type of inspiration and motivation, yet set with realism, really can help a company propel forward.
Very well said. Great advice. Chris, we need to wrap it up. How do we find out more, follow you online, get a copy of the book, hire you as a speaker?
Yep. So go to GrecoSpeaks.com. You'll see everything. You'll be able to purchase my book, read my bio. You can book me for speaking events. I'm starting to do more of those, and I really enjoy them. But go to GrecoSpeaks.com and you'll find everything that you need to know. And for your listeners, if they purchase my book and they fill out a very small form on my website and just mention your show, I will send them a signed copy.
Oh, great. How nice. Thank you.
Yeah.
Chris, great last name as well. I think Greco, it either sounds like a Bond supervillain or the name of an AI machine. What do you think it is?
I would like to say I like to think it's a common name. I'm just an average person trying to do extraordinary things.
I don't know. It sounds like a cool special name to me. So
yeah, anyway. Yeah, I hear you.
Chris, thanks for being with us, and we'd love to have you back. Take care.
Yeah, thank you.
And we will be right back.
Bye, bye, bye!
We are back this December 12th. I realize I didn't give you the date at the top of the show, as I am supposed to do. Excited to welcome back Wayne Elliott to the show. He is our favorite Canadian entrepreneur. Absolute fountain of wisdom, 55, 60 years in business, incredibly successful, just sold his big business to BlackRock. You don't get more successful than that. Today, we're going to talk about the IRS and the specialty revenue agents. Wayne has some amazing advice, and we're going to tell some great stories in this interview. So I hope you enjoy it. Here it is.
Very good.
Do you hate the IRS as much as we do?
No. I just, they're the smartest people that work for the federal government at their trade, at their skills. They're the most skilled people. That's what I'd like to talk about, and what happens when we get assessed, and then how normally people handle it.
Okay.
And how I've handled it successfully in the past, 3 times.
Is an assessment the same thing as an audit here in the States?
Yeah, it's they call it an assessment, where they just show up with a letter saying, Jim Beach, you owe us $800,000. And unlike the rest of the laws, where you're innocent till proven guilty, when it comes to tax, you're guilty until you prove yourself innocent. That's how that works.
Yes.
I got a lot of experience with it.
Well, tell us some of the stories. How do you respond when someone walks in like that? Are they allowed to seize assets at that second?
Well, they can't. Do you want to get started? I don't know if you want to introduce the show like you usually do, or how you want
to
start here.
Let's just go for it. Let's just run along. I've developed a trick that I've.
Well, used. I'd like to talk to the folks about the revenuers, the IRS in the United States and Revenue Canada, and the very common mistake that, in my experience with other business people, 99%. Of people handle it a certain way. So let's say that on your side of the border, the IRS, and I don't know if they do exactly the same thing, Jim, but in Canada here, our Canada Revenue Agency, they will, if they feel as though you owe them money, somebody told them a story or whatever, however they get their information, or they're disputing something you're claiming. With me, the last one was, in Canada, we have a small business deduction for smaller companies. And I think now you can make your first $750,000 in a year and get taxed at the lower rate of, instead of 53% in Canada, 26%. It's a small business deduction, they call it. So in my case, I started, you know, half a dozen companies. And quite honestly, arrange the ownership between family members so that we could have two separate small business deductions. In other words, two of the companies or the groups could claim that first profit as a small business. So quite legal. It wasn't illegal what we did. But the province of Ontario tax people came in and said, you know, you've made these claims. It's really all one. Wayne, you're the directing mind of all of it. Mind, M-I-N-D, mind. And we say you can't have the second deduction. And at that point, there was something like $1.5 million involved that the province said was owed. So it went, of course, they work with the federal agency. And so next thing, the federal people are in. And now here's what most business owners do in my experience, and I know hundreds of people in business. When they get assessed like this, okay, you know, Mr. Beach, your company owes $1 million to us. First of all, it's the only situation where you're not innocent until proven guilty is with the revenue department. That's a fact. When they assess you and say, Wayne, you owe $1 million, or your company owes $1 million, you are guilty until and unless you prove that you're not. So it works the opposite to the rest of the law, where you're innocent until proven guilty. It's the opposite. You're guilty until, if you can prove yourself not guilty. So that's the first thing. They have credible authority on both sides of the border. They can seize your assets, your bank accounts, freeze your account. They have unlimited powers, really. And my experience is that at their trade, their accountants, the revenue people, at their trade, they are by far the smartest government workers. They are the best at their trade. You know, we have prime ministers, and you have congress people and senators and governors, and we have premiers, not governors, and we have a prime minister, not a president, and we have members of parliament, not congress people. They just call them different. We have a Senate, too, which has far different responsibilities than in your country. In our country, a Senate is a patronage position. When you're leaving office as prime minister and you want to help some of your friends, you make them senators. Offices, chauffeurs, big paychecks, and they really have no function in Canada. They've even talked about being rid of the Senate. Your Senate's far different. It's the federal representatives in each state. Very powerful people. But anyway, so when they assess you, you are guilty until you owe that money, and the interest starts to tick the moment you're assessed. In fact, if they're coming after you for something that happened 4 years ago, for example, the interest starts from the date of the infraction, when you didn't do what you were supposed to do. So the other thing is there's great incentive not to mess with the revenue people, because in Canada, let's say that they say you owed $1 million. They can fine you up to double that. So you owe the million, the fine can be $2 million, and the interest runs at something like 18% a year. So there's real strong incentive to pay your taxes here in Canada, I can tell you. And these people are smart. They're accountants. They're very experienced. They know what to look for. They're used to catching cheaters, and they know exactly what they're doing. These are the smartest people at their trade that the government has. And so what most business people do, thinking that it's some kind of protection, that it's some kind of buffer, they'll call their accountant, then they'll call their lawyer. Well, let me tell you what happens on the revenuer's side when that happens. it's a break for them because of all the files sitting on their desk. As soon as you call a lawyer as the citizen they say owes the money, they simply hand that file over to the legal department of the revenue agency. So it's off their desk. They may have to answer some questions later for the lawyer representative of the government, but it's no longer their responsibility to get your money. The lawyer may say to them, you know, yes, freeze his accounts. Yes, seize those assets. But that's how it works. So you're not giving them extra trouble, the revenue officers, when you get your lawyer and accountant involved. It's easier for them. They just pass the file along to the government lawyers. So what I have, it's happened to me now in 50 years, Jim, three times, where they came in and said I owed them a lot of money. And the first two times, I would have had no way of paying the amount of money. It was a large amount of money. And it wasn't true. It wasn't right. But each of the, and then it happened with my wife, who's a U.S. citizen. She's a landed immigrant to Canada. So she can live here, work here, pay her taxes here. And because taxes are higher here in Canada, she never owes money to the United States. If it were the other way around, a Canadian working in America, paying taxes there, they would owe more taxes to Canada so that you're paying, you know, Canada's rate in the end. So anyway, my wife has never had to pay a nickel in the 20 years she's been here in Canada, never paid a nickel to the United States Revenue Department. But one time they assessed her saying, they fined her $2,500 a year for 7 years. And they said, okay, you owe us $19,000. Why? Because there's a box on the tax return, and Americans are obliged under your tax laws to claim everything in the world that you own. So my wife, and it's the same in Canada, so my wife owned a home in Cleveland, and she kept it until her mom passed away. And then she sold it. So anyway, she had sold it by the time they came and said, you owe this $19,000. So in my experience, and what we did in my wife's case was handwrite, not typewrite, handwrite a letter to the revenue office stating our case, that it was my wife's home. Now, the tax people that do her tax returns neglected to checkmark this box saying she owned a home in the United States. That was the crime, if you will. That was where we didn't do what we were supposed to do. And the tax people that do our taxes said they didn't even know she was American. So that was their excuse. So we handwrote a letter to Revenue Canada saying, you know, this is my home. It has never produced any revenue. I've never rented it out for so much as a night. It's where I stay when I visit my mother, my brothers, and my sister in Cleveland. And please remove this assessment and fine. I'm sorry that the box didn't get checked, but it isn't a source of income. And the reason for the handwritten letter, in my experience, it's more personal. It shows you're not some giant corporation. You're not calling an accountant. They're not dealing with your lawyer. They're dealing with you directly. So there's the personal side of things. And, you know, we were fortunate that the officer at Revenue Canada read my wife's letter and got back to us and canceled the assessment. She didn't owe the $19,000. The two times in my experience in the business over all these decades, for a lot of money, to me, I handled it the same way. No accountant, no lawyer, met with them face-to-face, you know, handwritten letters, and both times they dropped 100% of the assessment. So people that think they have a buffer by getting their accountant and their lawyer in between them and the government, that will pretty much always work against you. Number one, your lawyer doesn't care about you as much as you care about you. Neither does your accountant. I mean, it's their job to do their job, but if you think they're thinking about you when they go home at night, they're not. Their heart, so to speak, is not in it. And it's just another way for them to make money. If they're representing you to the revenue service, you're just another customer. And so in my experience, keep it personal, write the letter and handwrite it. It's just more personal and state your case. Now, listen, if you truly owe them the money, Jim, they're going to get it. That's the first thing I'd say. If you cheated the government and they catch you, you're going to end up paying the money or lose something that you have. There's no doubt about it. They have great, tremendous powers like nobody else. The only agency, federal agency, that has more power or as much power in a different way is the Immigration Service. Not customs and immigration. Immigration can hold you. If I tried to get into the United States today and they didn't want me in, they can hold me in a cell for 72 hours without a phone call. There's no other part of the law that allows the government to do that. But so immigration's powerful. They have to control who's coming in and out of the country. And the revenue service is the most powerful because they can seize all your assets. They can shut you down and turn your lights out today. So fighting them, I mean, I guess at the end of the day, if you didn't do what they say you did, and you can't get them to agree that you didn't do it or cheat them, then I guess, you know, you may have to fight. But don't think you're troubling the officer. He just passes or she just passes that along to the legal department, and it isn't that officer's problem anymore. And yet 99% at least of people make this mistake, Jim, of thinking the lawyer and the accountant is some kind of buffer or protection for them. It's just more expense is all it is. It doesn't mean a damn thing at the end of the day. It just costs you more money because you got to pay the accountant and the lawyer. And I just don't. And some of the biggest people, you know, I'm a flea on the elephant's behind compared to them. And they do it too. And I don't know of one example with the hundreds of people I know in business and the many that has had this issue. I mean, this is the revenue department's job is to get their money, get their taxes. I don't know one of them that has won by using the accountant and the lawyer to defend them. I don't know of one. And now we didn't legitimately owe any of this money, any of the three times. But I sure didn't throw a lawyer in there just to increase the pain and the cost and drag things out. What we did do after the last one where they said I was the directing mind of these companies, we met with the officer, a lady, very experienced lady. And, you know, we just had a very frank meeting and I said, listen, this just isn't true. I said, I'll give you some examples in the battery business. I'm over my head. Yes, I'm a businessman, very experienced, but this is science. I'm a science dummy. I never studied it. It's truly over my head. The guy that runs that business, he's up there at the office. His name's James. He knows all about the business. He's the directing mind of that business. I said, here we are sitting in the scrapyard office. My oldest son runs this. He can tell you the price we pay for every type of metal today, and he can tell you the price we sell every type of metal today, and I can't answer any of those questions for you today. I'm not the directing mind of this business either. I am the directing mind of the shipbreaking business, and that's the only business that I'm the directing mind of. And so we just had this frank conversation. The officer wanted to see the general ledger and something else. I've never seen these books that she wanted to see. I've never had anything to do with that part of our businesses. My sister looked after finance and administration for decades. And then for more decades, this young fellow I've known since he was a little boy, and his grandpa worked with me, one of the best men I ever worked with. He's handled this. So you know, I don't even really, I can't really decipher page 2 of a financial statement, Jim. I get the first page. profit, loss, expenses. That second page, how everything has to marry up and the numbers marry up.
Page.
I really don't.
It's all a lie. It's just we're going to make it balance even if it doesn't. I hate that page.
Totally yeah, I that's the way I feel about it. Let's face it, the important page is the first page. Do we make money or lose money? Isn't that the important thing?
Yep.
And all the rest of this is, to me, just gibberish, really, that I pay no mind to. Don't really understand it. I've been in business 54 years, but I that first page is the important page, you see. So I've had very little to do with any of that. I don't know what a general ledger looks like. I gather it's some kind of book. And that's what this last officer wanted to see, that and something else. And I've forgotten what it was. So she went up to the head office with our CFO, got the look at what she needed, and then dropped the assessment after our meeting. So personal side to everything, Jim, whether you get pulled over by a police officer that says you're speeding or your blinker didn't work or whatever he pulled you over for or she, same at the border. You can get the friendliest man or woman in the world that doesn't ask you but a question or two and off you go. Or you can get somebody that decides that, no, I think I should detain this person and send them inside for questioning and whatever. So there's always a personal side to everything. You know, there's a human. It's a human being that's a revenue officer. It's a human being that's a police officer. A human being is an immigration officer. And you can't lose sight of that. So when you get the lawyer and the accountant thinking that you've got this buffer protection in between you, you have no protection in between you. You've really just made it worse because it's going to cost you more in the end because your own lawyer and accountant have to be paid. And you've got to remember the personal side of things. You're better off stating your own case to an officer, whether it's a police officer pulled you over on the road or it's a revenue service officer. You're always better off sticking with the human side of it. And telling the truth if you didn't do what they think you did, and you're just that much better off. So I decided I wanted to talk to you about this today because it's just so important. The easiest way is the most direct way, Jim. You know, I like you, I was an athlete, you know, quickest way, quickest route to the basket, quickest route to the goal line. That's what we're trained to do. And really, the in business, the best is the same way as the best. Fastest way to the goal line is the best. You don't need to be thinking about this for 2 years while you owe the money. And you hear about it all the time, Jim, some of our famous entertainment people, the singers and guys like Willie Nelson and famous actors. Well, when they get paid, I gather, the tax isn't taken off it like it is for an employee at work. The tax is automatically taken off your paycheck at work, wherever you work. And then the other submissions in Canada, health tax, unemployment insurance, all this stuff's taken off your check. Well, if you're a rock star or a movie star, I gather they just pay you. Pardon?
Or an entrepreneur. An entrepreneur doesn't have their money taken out either. So
that's right.
We have to deal with this.
That's right. So the biggest mistake, obviously, I guess it's human nature. You know, it's happened to so many athletes that are broke the year after they quit playing ball. They're broke because when they were making the big money, you know, they put the minimum down payment on everything, buying homes and cars and this and that. And then their income gets cut off and they lose it all overnight. You know, you got to pay your taxes. And I'm sure there's people that have cheated and gotten away with it, Jim, but that's a tough bet, you know, that your number won't come up and that they don't appraise you or assess you rather, or do a net worth on you or investigate you. It's like Russian roulette in my mind. Business is difficult enough, challenging enough. You sure don't need to take on the government, and you don't need to take on the smartest people they have at their trade in the government, because they're smart people. They know their stuff. And so you're just adding to your own pain, really, your own expense. You go to bed thinking about it, wake up thinking about it, because it's not going away. So just the quickest route to the goal line, you know, you sit down with an officer, you plead your case. You know, if you're in a situation where you need mercy or you need time to pay, from what I've heard, they'll work with you. They're not in the business of putting people out of business or ruining their lives, but they are in the business of getting the government's money. It's how the government operates. They got to get their money. So I really wanted to bring that up today.
That's a great point, Wayne. Let me tell you, let me tell a quick story that jumped into my mind. Oh, 20 years ago or something, I was driving on a busy road and wanted to pull into McDonald's or somewhere. And I made a left turn, and about halfway through the turn, I saw a car that I had not seen before. I don't know where the car came from, but I was about to hit it, and I was going to hit the car. And so I made a very aggressive move. I floored it, hit the gas as hard as I could. And I turned about 90 degrees, and instead of going in the entrance, I went in the exit. And there was a car there, and I had to almost, I mean, I barely made it through. There wasn't a lot of room, but I made it. And I went into the McDonald's and was in line. And I saw a cop car come into the McDonald's with their lights on, and I knew immediately that it was me. And so I was like, what do I do? Do I hide in the bathroom? What's my strategy here? And I decided, and I don't know why I decided this, I immediately ran out to the cop. And I went out to him as fast as I could, and I was waving my arms, and he rolled down the window, and you could see he was furious. And I was like, it was me. It was me. I am so sorry. I effed up. I got in the middle of the lane and saw that I wasn't going to make it. And so I did that crazy move, and I'm so sorry. I deserve a ticket. I'm a jerk, but I effed up, and I got in the middle of the intersection. And the only way to not get hit and to cause an accident was to do what I did, and I'm so sorry. What do you think happened?
Yeah. You didn't get the ticket.
No, he walked away, and we had a laugh about it. He said, thank you so much. No one's done that in a week to me. You know, thank you for admitting it, and that your punishment was your admittance. So,
yeah. There's just a great example. See, you took the personal, the direct human approach. You apologized. It's the smartest thing to do. That police officer is a human being too. And I've done the same things, Jim. I've done the same things as well in the car. I got caught speeding. I didn't know they changed the speed limit going through a native reservation road, or a road on native reservation. The highway was in the reservation at that point out in Nova Scotia. And the speed limit had always been 90 kilometers. I've done the drive 45 times. And the policeman pulled me over, and I said, hi, officer, what's the, why'd you pull me over? He said, well, you were speeding. I said, geez, as soon as I saw you behind me, I looked down. I was only doing 90. I don't think I was speeding. Are you sure it was me? He said, oh, I said, I've been through here 45 times. I respect the law. He said, well, you probably didn't notice, but there were two people killed last year on this road, and the speed limit got reduced to 70 kilometers. I'm sorry, I missed that. I didn't see that sign. I guess I was daydreaming, knowing where I was going, because I've done it so many times. He said, well, that's understandable. He said, I see you're from Ontario, and appreciate you apologizing. So he said, let's just call it a warning then. Now you know to slow down going through this section. I said, oh, I sure do. Well, thanks a million, officer. And off I went, you know. So usually the truth, you know, some people can't handle the truth, but as the saying goes, Jim, the truth will set you free. You're not going to convince that officer you weren't speeding, or that you didn't do that move that you did in your car. He saw you. Yeah. So, you know, that's just the best way. And it's funny how people will react, you know, call the lawyer. I'm surprised, Jim, when people go into business, the first thing they seem to do is call the lawyer.
Yep.
Well, lawyers, like accountants, are horrible businessmen.
And they charge a lot per hour, and they love it when you need a problem like that, because they're just seeing you as a revenue stream.
Well, it's a fact. Yep. In this country, accountants are the second worst people in business behind doctors, medical doctors. It's true. It's true. So you know, and yet people call the accountant and the lawyer first. No, I've started businesses, and my sister would be upset with me, but I've started businesses and let her know a few weeks later, and she had to do all the catch up and do all that. Well, that wasn't right or nice of me, but I don't call a lawyer or an accountant when I'm going to start a business. I never have, and I never will. What the hell do they know about business? Yeah. You know, as my dad would say, they know what's between the horse's rear end and his tail. Nothing about it. And so, you know, you got to stay involved yourself. And in my experience, it's just the best way. If you're going to fight the government, oh, boy. Yep. They have unlimited resources, unlimited people, unlimited time, and we don't, you know, simple as that.
Yep. So, Wayne, we're about out of time. As a matter of fact, we are out of time, but I just have to tell this really quick story and then we will wrap it up. About 10 years ago, I was at home and the police showed up with a search warrant and I was under investigation for federal crimes, and I cooperated and they left, and you know, the police said, we will call you and we'll arrange a meeting to go over all of this evidence and everything. Well, my first instinct was to hire a lawyer, as you said, but I was like, ooh, that's going to be expensive. Anyway, I didn't get called downtown to talk to the police for 2 years. Imagine what my legal bill would have been in those 2 years. Never hired a lawyer, went downtown by myself, walked into the room. We talked for 8 hours nonstop. And I walked out at the end, and I had to produce a couple more documents to prove my claims. But that was the end of it. I got the documents they needed. There were no charges ever pressed. They never apologized, of course, but no charges were ever charged. You know, I didn't get charged with anything. I didn't have to do a plea bargain. And it went away. And my two thoughts were, my legal bill would have been $250,000 if I had hired a lawyer, even though they did absolutely nothing. And I think that I looked a lot more innocent by walking in by myself with absolutely no lawyer and just defended myself, because you know what? I was innocent. And so hiring the
and then nobody can speak for you as well as you can speak for yourself, Jim. Exactly. You know, don't have to be educated. Just be honest, hat in hand, humble. And that's the human side of it. So good for you. That's the way I've always done it and always will.
Wayne, as always, thank you so much for being with us. We are out of time for today, but back tomorrow. Be safe, everyone. Take care, and go make $1 million. Bye now.